No.
After all, Mr. Smith said, none of us have actually seen Dr. Philippot's body. One mustn't judge hastily. 2. For some days after my visit to the embassy, I heard nothing from Martha, and I was worried. I played the scene over and over again in my mind, trying to judge whether any irrevocable words had been spoken, but I remembered none. I was relieved, but angered too, by her short, untender note when it came at last. Angel was better, the pain was over, she could meet me, if I wished, by the statue. I went to the rendezvous and found nothing changed. But even in the lack of change and in her tenderness, I found cause for resentment. Oh, yes, she was ready to make love now in her own good time. I said, we can't live in a car. She said, I've been thinking a lot about that, too. We shall ruin ourselves with secrecy. I will come to the Trianon, if we can avoid your guests. These Smiths will be in bed by this time. We'd better take both cars in case... I can say I've brought you a message from my husband. An invitation, something of the sort. You go first. I'll give you 5 minutes. I had expected a night of argument, and then suddenly the door which I had pushed against so often before flew open. I walked through and found only disappointment. I thought, she thinks quicker than I do. She knows the ropes. The Smiths surprised me when I reached the hotel by their audible presence. There was a clatter of spoons and the clinking of tins and a gentle punctuation of voices. They had taken over the veranda tonight for their evening yeastroll and barmeen. I had wondered sometimes what they spoke about together when they were alone. Did they refight old campaigns? I parked the car and stood a while and listened before I mounted the steps. I heard Mr. Smith say, "You've put in 2 spoonfuls already, dear." "Oh, no, I'm sure I haven't." "Just try first and you'll see." From the silence that followed, I gathered he was right. "I have often wondered," Mr. Smith said, "what happened to that poor man who was asleep in the pool our first night. Do you remember, dear?"
"Of course I remember, and I wish I had gone down as I wanted to at the time," Mrs. Smith said. "I asked Joseph next day, but I think he lied to me."
"Not lied, dear. He didn't understand." I walked up the stairs, and they greeted me. "Not in bed yet?" I asked, rather stupidly.
Mr. Smith had to catch up with his mail.
I wondered how I could shift them from the veranda before Martha arrived. I said, "You mustn't be too late. The secretary is taking us to Duvalierville tomorrow. We start early." "That's all right," Mr. Smith said. "My wife will stay behind. I don't want her bumped along the roads in the sun."
"I can stand it quite as well as you can."
"I have to stand it, dear. For you, there's no necessity. It will give you a chance to catch up on your lessons in Hugo." "But you need your sleep, too," I said. "I can do with very little, Mr. Brown. You remember, dear, that second night in Nashville?"
I had noticed how Nashville came back often to their common memory, perhaps because it was the most glorious of their campaigns.
"Do you know whom I saw in town today?" Mr. Smith asked.
"No."
"Mr. Jones. He was coming out of the palace with a very fat man in uniform. The guards saluted. Of course, I don't suppose they were saluting Mr. Jones."
"He seems to be doing pretty well," I said. "From prison to palace, it's almost better than log cabin to White House."
"I have always felt that Mr. Jones has great character. I'm very glad he's prospering."
"If it's not at someone else's expense." At even that hint of criticism, Mr. Smith's expression slammed shut. He stirred his yeastroll nervously to and fro, and I was seriously tempted to tell him of the telegram sent to the captain of the Medea. Wasn't it possibly a flaw in character to believe so passionately in the integrity of all the world? I was saved by the sound of a car, and a moment later Martha came up the steps.
"Why, it's that charming Mrs. Pineda,"
Mr. Smith exclaimed with relief. He rose and busied himself arranging a seat. Martha looked at me with despair and said, "It's late. I can't stop. I've just brought a message from my husband." She produced an envelope from her bag and pushed it into my hand. "Have a whiskey while you are here," I said. "No, no. I really must get home." Mrs. Smith remarked a little stiffly, I thought, but perhaps it was in my imagination. "Don't hurry away, Mrs. Pineda, because of us. Mr. Smith and I are just off to bed. Come along, dear." "I have to go in any case. My son has mumps, you see." She was explaining too much. "Mumps?" Mrs. Smith said. "I'm so sorry to hear it, Mrs. Pineda. In that case, you will certainly want to be at home." "I'll see you to your car," I said, and got her away. We drove to the end of the drive and stopped. "What went wrong?" Martha asked. "You shouldn't have given me a letter addressed to you in my handwriting." "I wasn't prepared. It was the only one I had in my bag. She couldn't have seen." "She sees an awful lot, unlike her husband."
"I'm sorry. What shall we do?"
"We can wait until they're in bed."
"And then creep by and see the door open suddenly, and Mrs. Smith?"
"They're not on my floor."
"Then we'll meet her for certain at the corner of the stairs. I can't."
"Another meeting spoilt," I said.
"Darling, that first night when you returned by the pool, I wanted so much."
"They still have the John Barrymore suite just overhead."
"We can get under the trees, and the lights are out now. It's dark. Even Mrs. Smith can't see in the dark."
I felt an inexplicable reluctance. I said, "The mosquitoes," trying to account for it.
"Damn the mosquitoes."
The last time we had been together, we quarreled because of her unwillingness. Now it was my turn. I thought angrily, if her house must not be defiled, why should my house be any less sacred? And then I wondered, sacred to what? A dead body in a bathing pool? We left the car and went as softly as we could towards the pool. A light was on in the Barrymore suite, and the shadow of a Smith passed across the mosquito netting. We lay down in a shallow declivity under the palms, like bodies given a common burial, and I remembered another death, Marcel hanging from the chandeliers. Neither of us would ever die for love. We would grieve and separate and find another. We belonged to the world of comedy and not of tragedy. The fireflies moved among the trees and lit intermittently a world in which we had no part. We, the uncolored, were all of us too far away from home. I lay as inert as Monsieur le Ministre.
"What's the matter, darling? Are you angry about something?"
"No,"
she said humbly. "You don't want me?"
"Not here. Not now."
"I angered you last time, but I wanted to make it up."
I said, "I never told you what happened that night, why I sent you away with Joseph."
"I thought you were protecting me from the Smiths."
Dr. Filippo was lying dead in the pool just over there. You see that patch of moonlight?
"Killed?"
"He had cut his own throat to escape the Tonton Macoute." She moved a little away.
"I understand. Oh, God, it's terrible, the things that happen. They are like nightmares."
"Only the nightmares are real in this place, more real than Mr. Smith and his vegetarian center, more real than ourselves." We lay quietly side by side in our grave, and I loved her as I had never done in the Peugeot or the bedroom above Hamid's store. We approached one another by words more nearly than we had ever approached by touch. She said,
"I envy you and Luis. You believe in something. You have explanations."
"Have I? Do you think I still believe?"
She said, "My father believed too."
It was the first time she had ever mentioned him to me. "In what?" I asked.
"In the God of the Reformation," she said. "He was a Lutheran, a pious Lutheran. He was lucky to believe in anything. And people in Germany, too, cut their throats to escape his justice.
Yes, the situation isn't abnormal. It belongs to human life. Cruelty's like a searchlight. It sweeps from one spot to another. We can only escape it for a time. We are trying to hide now under the palm trees.
Instead of doing anything.
Instead of doing anything.
She said, I almost prefer my father.
No.
You know about him?
Your husband told me.
At least he wasn't a diplomat.
Or a hotel keeper who depends on the tourist trade.
There's nothing wrong in that.
A capitalist waiting for the dollars to return.
You speak like a communist.
Sometimes I wish I were.
But you are Catholics, you and Luis.
Yes, we were both brought up by the Jesuits, I said. They taught us to reason, so at least we know the kind of part we play now.
Now?
We lay there, holding each other for a long while. Sometimes I wonder whether it was not the happiest moment we ever knew together. For the first time, we had trusted each other with something more than a caress. 3. We drove out next day to Duvalierville, Mr. Smith and I, and the minister, with a Tonton Macoute for a driver. Perhaps he was there to protect us, perhaps to observe us, perhaps just to help us pass the roadblocks, for this was the road to the north, along which, as most people in the city hoped, the tanks from Santo Domingo would one day come. I wondered what good the 3 shabby militiamen at the roadblock would be then. Hundreds of women were flocking into the capital for market, riding side-saddle on their bourrique. They stared at the fields on either side and paid us no attention. We didn't exist in their world. Buses went by, painted in stripes of red and yellow and blue. There might be little food in the land, but there was always color. The deep blue shadows sat permanently on the mountain slopes. The sea was peacock green. Green was everywhere in all its varieties, the poison bottle green of sisal slashed with black, the pale green of banana trees beginning to turn yellow at the tip to match the sand at the edge of the flat green sea. The land was stormy with color. A big American car went by with reckless speed on the bad road and covered us with dust, and only the dust lacked color. The minister brought out a bright scarlet handkerchief and dabbed his eyes.
"Salut!" he exclaimed.
Mr. Smith put his mouth close to my ear and whispered,
"Did you see who those people were?"
"No."
"I do believe one of them was Mr. Jones. I may have been mistaken. They went very fast."
"It seems unlikely," I said. On the flat, shoddy plain between the hills and the sea, a few white one-room boxes had been constructed, a cement playground, and an immense cockpit, which among the small houses looked almost as impressive as the Colosseum. They stood together in a bowl of dust, which, when we left the car, whirled around us in the wind of the approaching thunderstorm. By night it would have turned to mud again. I wondered, in the wilderness of cement, where the notional bricks had come from for Dr. Philippa's coffin.
"Is that a Greek theater?" Mr. Smith asked with interest.
"No, it's where they kill cocks." His mouth twitched, but he put the pain away from him. To feel pain was a kind of criticism. He said,
"I don't see many folk around here."
The Secretary for Social Welfare said proudly, "There were several hundred on this very spot, living in miserable mud huts. We had to clear the ground. It was quite a major operation."
"Where did they go?"
"I suppose some went into town, some into the hills, to relatives."
"Will they come back when the city's built?"
"Oh, well, you know, we are planning for a better class of people here." Beyond the cockpit there were 4 houses built with tilted wings, like wrecked butterflies. They resembled some of the houses of Brasilia seen through the wrong end of a telescope.
"And who will live in these?" Mr. Smith asked.
"These are for tourists."
"Tourists?" Mr. Smith asked.
Even the sea had receded out of sight. There was nothing anywhere but the great cockpit, the cement field, the dust, the road, and the stony hillside. Outside one of the white boxes, a negro with white hair sat on a hard chair under a sign that showed him to be a justice of the peace. He was the only human being in sight. He must have had a lot of influence to be installed so soon. There was no sign of men working, though a bulldozer stood on the cement playground with one wheel detached. "The visitors who come to see Duvalierville." He led us nearer to one of the houses. It was no different from the other houses, except for the useless wings, which I could imagine dropping off in the hard rains. "Now one of these, they are designed by a finest architect, might do for your center. You wouldn't have to begin then on a bare site." "I had thought of something larger." "You could take over the whole group." "What would happen to your tourists then?" I asked. "We would build some more over there," he said, waving his hand at the dry, insignificant plain. "It seems a bit out of the world," Mr. Smith said gently. "We are going to house 5,000 people here, for a start." "Where will they work?" "We shall bring industries to them. The government believes in decentralization." "And the cathedral?" "It will be over there, beyond the bulldozer." Around the corner of the great cockpit came seesawing one other human being. The Justice of Peace was not, after all, the sole inhabitant of the new city. It already had its beggar, too. He must have been sleeping in the sun until he was woken by our voices. Perhaps he thought that the architect's dream had come true, and there really were tourists in Duvalierville. He had very long arms and no legs, and he moved imperceptibly nearer like a rocking horse. Then he saw our driver and his dark glasses and his gun, and he stopped. Instead, he set up a crooning murmur, and from under his torn cobweb of a shirt, he drew a small wooden statuette, which he held out towards us. I said, "You have your beggars, then?" "He is no beggar," the minister explained. "He is an artist." He spoke to the Tonton Macoute, who went and fetched the statuette. It was the figure of a half-naked girl, indistinguishable from dozens in the Syrian stores that waited for gullible tourists who never came now. "Let me make you a present," the minister said, handing the statuette to Mr. Smith, who took it with embarrassment. "An example of Haitian art?" "I must pay the man," Mr. Smith said. "No need. The government looks after him." The minister began to lead the way back to the car, his hand on Mr. Smith's elbow to guide him over the broken ground. The beggar rocked to and fro, making sounds of melancholy and desperation. No words were distinguishable. I think he had no roof to his mouth. "What is he saying?" Mr. Smith asked. The minister ignored the question. "Later," he said, "we will have a proper art center here where the artists can live and relax and get their inspiration from nature. Haitian art is famous. Our pictures are collected by many Americans, and there are examples in the Museum of Modern Art in New York." Mr. Smith said, "I don't care what you say, I'm going to pay that man." He shook off the protecting hand of the Secretary for Social Welfare and ran back towards the cripple. He pulled out a bunch of dollar bills and held them out. The cripple looked at him with incredulity and fear. Our driver made a motion to interfere, but I blocked his way. Mr. Smith bent down and pressed the money into the cripple's hand. The cripple, with an enormous effort, began to rock back towards the cockpit. Perhaps he had a hole there in which he could hide the money. There was an expression of rage and disgust on the driver's face, as though he had been robbed. I think he contemplated drawing his gun. His fingers went to his belt, and putting an end to at least one artist. But Mr. Smith was coming back along his line of fire. "He's made a sale, all right," Mr. Smith said with a satisfied smile. The Justice of the Peace had risen to watch the transaction outside his box beyond the playground. Standing, he was an enormous man. He put his hand over his eyes to see better in the hard sunlight. We took our places in the car, and there was a momentary silence. Then the secretary said, "Where would you like to go now?" "Home," said Mr. Smith laconically. "I could show you the site we have chosen for the college." "I've seen enough," Mr. Smith said. "I'd rather go home, if you don't mind." I looked back. The Justice of the Peace was running fast on long loping legs across the cement playground, and the cripple was rocking back with desperation towards the cockpit. He reminded me of a sand crab scuttling to its hole. He had only another 20 yards to go, but he hadn't a chance. When I looked round a minute later, Duvalierville was hidden by the dust cloud of our car. I said nothing to Mr. Smith, for he was smiling happily at a good action accomplished. I think he was already rehearsing the story he would tell to Mrs. Smith, a story which would enable her to share his sense of happiness. After we had gone a few miles, the minister said, "Of course, the tourist site is partly the responsibility of the Secretary for Public Works, and the Secretary for Tourism would also have to be consulted, but he is a personal friend of mine. If you cared to make the necessary arrangements with me, I would see that the others were satisfied." "Satisfied?" Mr. Smith asked. He was not wholly guileless. Though he had been unshaken by the beggars in the post office, I believe the city of Duvalierville had opened his eyes. "I mean," the minister said. He produced a box of cigars from the back of the car. "You will not want to be involved in endless discussions. I will represent your views to my colleagues. Take a couple of cigars, Professor." "No, thank you, I don't smoke." The driver did. He saw what was going on in his mirror, and leaning back, he abstracted 2 cigars. One he lit, and one he put in his shirt pocket. "My views," Mr. Smith said. "If you want them, you shall have them. I don't see your Duvalierville being exactly a center of progress. It's too remote."
"You would prefer a site in the capital?"
"I'm beginning to reconsider the whole project," Mr. Smith said, in a voice so final that even the minister relapsed into uneasy silence. 4. And yet Mr. Smith lingered on. Perhaps when he went over the events of the day with Mrs. Smith, the aid he had given the cripple re-established his sense of hope, hope that he could do something for the human race. Perhaps she strengthened his faith and fought his doubts. She was more a fighter than he. Already by the time we arrived at the Hotel Trianon, after more than an hour of gloomy silence, he had begun to revise his severest criticisms. The thought that he might possibly have been unfair haunted him. He had said good-bye with distant courtesy to the Secretary for Social Welfare and thanked him for a very interesting excursion. But suddenly on the steps of the veranda he halted and turned to me. He said, "That word, satisfy, I guess I took him up too hard. It made me sore, but then English isn't his native tongue. Maybe he didn't intend—" "He intended it all right, but he hadn't meant to say it so openly to you." "I wasn't very favorably impressed by that project, I'll allow, but you know, even Brasilia, and they have all the technicians they need, it's something to want a thing, even if you fail."
"I don't think they are quite ripe for vegetarianism."
"I was thinking the same, but perhaps—"
"Perhaps you must have enough cash to be carnivorous first." He gave me a quick look of reproach and said,
"I'll talk it all over with Mrs. Smith."
Then he left me alone, at least I thought I was alone, until I entered the office and found the British chargé there. Joseph had furnished him, I saw, with his special rum punch. "A lovely colour," the chargé said, holding it up to the light when I entered.
"It's the grenadine."
"I'm going on leave," he said, "next week, and so I'm saying my adieus."
"You won't be sorry to be out of here."
"Oh, it's interesting," he said. "Interesting. There are worse places. The Congo, perhaps. But people die quicker there. At least I'm glad, the Chargé said, that I'm not leaving a fellow countryman in jail. Mr. Smith's intervention proved successful. I wonder if it was Mr. Smith. I got the impression Jones would have got out anyway on his own steam. I wish I knew what makes the steam. I won't pretend to you I haven't had inquiries. Like Mr. Smith, he carried a letter of introduction, but like Mr. Smith, I suspect it was to the wrong man. That was why they arrested him, I imagine, when they took it off him at the airport. I have a suspicion his letter was to one of the army officers. He came to see me the night before last, the chargé said. I wasn't expecting him. He was very late. I was just going to bed. I haven't seen him since the night he was released. I think his friend Captain Concasseur doesn't regard me as sufficiently reliable. I was there, you see, when Concasseur broke up Philippot's funeral. Jones gave me the impression he was engaged on some sort of project for the government. Where's he staying? They've put him up at the Villa Creole. You know, the government took the place over. They lodged the Polish mission there after the Americans left, the only guests they've had up till now, and the Poles departed very quickly. Jones has a car and a driver. Of course, the driver may be his jailer, too. He's a tonton macoud. You haven't any idea what the project could be? Not a clue. He ought to be careful. To sup with the Baron, you need a very long spoon. That's more or less what I told him, but I think he knows well enough. He's not a stupid man. Were you aware that he had been in Leopoldville? I think he did say once. It came out quite accidentally. He was there at the time of Lumumba. I checked up with London. Apparently he was helped out of Leopoldville by our consul. That doesn't mean much. A lot of people have been helped out of the Congo. The consul gave him his ticket to London, but he got off in Brussels. That's nothing against him either, of course. I think what he really wanted with me was to check up whether the British Embassy had the right of asylum. In case of difficulties, I had to tell him no, no legal right. Is he in trouble already? No, but he's sort of surveying his ground, like Robinson Crusoe climbing the highest tree. But I didn't much fancy his man Friday. Who do you mean? His driver, a man as fat as Gracia with a lot of gold teeth. I think he must collect gold teeth. He probably has good opportunities. I wish your friend Maggio would take that big gold molar out and put it in his safe. A gold tooth always attracts greed. He drank the last of his rum. This was a noonday for visitors. I had got into my bathing trunks and dived into the pool only a little before the next comer arrived. I found I had to conquer some repugnance at bathing there, and the repugnance returned when I saw young Filippo looking down at me from the margin of the pool, standing just above the spot at the deep end where his uncle had bled to death. I had been swimming under water, and I had not heard his approach. I was startled when his voice came through the skin of water. "Monsieur Brown." "Why, Filippo, I didn't know you were here." "I did what you advised, Monsieur Brown. I went and saw Jones." I had quite forgotten our conversation. "Why?" "Surely you remember the Brenn?" Perhaps I had not taken him seriously enough. I had thought of the Brenn as a new poetic symbol of his, like the pylons in the poems of my youth. After all, those poets never joined the electricity board. "He's staying up at the Villa Creole with Captain Concasseur. I waited last night until I saw Concasseur go out, but there was still Jones's driver sitting at the foot of the stairs, the one with the gold teeth, the man who ruined Joseph." "He did that? How do you know?" "Some of us keep a record. We have a lot of names on it now. My uncle, I am ashamed to say, was on the same list, because of the pump in the Rue de Sey. I don't think it was altogether his fault.
Nor do I. Now I have persuaded them his name belongs to the other list, the list of victims.
I hope you keep your files in a very safe place.
At least they have copies of them across the border.
How did you get to see Jones?
I climbed into the kitchen through a window, and then I went up the service stairs. I knocked on his door. I pretended to have a message from Concasseur. He was in bed.
He must have been a bit startled.
Monsieur Brown, do you know what those two are up to?
No. Do you?
I am not sure. I think so, but I'm not sure.
What did you say to him?
I asked him to help us. I told him the raiders across the border could do nothing to shift the doctor. They kill a few tontons macoute, and then they get killed themselves. They have no training. They have no brains. I told him how 7 men once captured the army barracks because they had Tommy guns.
Why are you telling this to me? He asked. You are not an agent provocateur, are you?
I said no. I said, if we hadn't been prudent so long, Papa Doc wouldn't be there in the palace. Then Jones said, I've seen the president.
Jones has seen Papa Doc? I asked incredulously.
He told me so, and I believe him. He's up to something, he and Captain Concasseur. He told me Papa Doc was as interested in weapons and training as I was.
The army's gone, Jones said. Not that it was any good to anyone, and what the Tonton Macoute have left of the American arms is all rusting away for want of proper care.
So you see it's no good coming to me, unless you have a better proposition than the president's named already.
But he didn't say what proposition.
I tried to see the papers on his desk. They looked like the plans of a building. But he said to me, leave those alone, they mean a lot to me. Then he offered me a drink to show he had nothing personally against me. He said to me, one has to earn a living the best way one can. What do you do? I said, I used to write verses. Now I want a brain gun. And training. Training too. He asked me, are there many of you? And I told him that numbers were not so important. If the 7 men had had 7 brains. I said, the brains are not magical, Filippo. Sometimes they stick, just as a silver bullet can miss.
You are going back to voodoo, Filippo.
And why not? Perhaps the gods from Dahomey are what we need now.
You are a Catholic. You believe in reason.
The voodooists are Catholic, too, and we don't live in a world of reason. Perhaps only Ogun Ferai can teach us to fight.
Was that all Jones said to you?
No. He said, come on, have a scotch, old man. But I wouldn't take the drink. I went down the front stairs so that the driver could see me. I wanted him to see me.
Not very safe for you if they question Jones.
Without a brain, the only weapon I have is distrust. I thought that if they began to distrust Jones, something might happen.
There were tears in his voice. A poet's tears for a lost world, or a child's tears for the brain that no one would give him. I swam away to the shallow end that I mightn't see him weep. My lost world was the naked girl in the pool, and what was his? I remember the evening when he read his derivative verses to me and to Petit Pierre and to the young beat novelist who wanted to be the Kerouac of Haiti. There was an aging painter, too, who drove a camion during the day and worked at night with his calloused fingers at the American Art Center, where they gave him paints and canvases. Propped against the veranda was his latest picture, Cows in a Field, but not the kind of cows they sold south of Piccadilly, and a pig with his head stuck through a hoop, among green banana leaves, darkened by the perpetual storm coming down the mountain. It had something which my art student failed to find. I rejoined him by the end of the pool when I had given him time enough to check the tears. "Do you remember," I asked him, "that young man who wrote a novel called La Route du Sud?" "He is in San Francisco, where he always wanted to be. He escaped after the massacre in Jacmel." "I was thinking of the evening when you read to us." "I don't regret those days. They were not real. The tourists and the dancing, and the man dressed up as Baron Samedi. Baron Samedi is not an entertainment for visitors." "They brought money to the island." "Who saw the money? At least Papa Doc has taught us to live without money." "Come to dinner on Saturday, Filippo, and meet the only tourists here." "No, I have something to do that night." "Be careful, at any rate. I wish you'd start writing poems again." He flashed white teeth at me in a malicious smile. "The poem about Haiti has already been written once and for all. You know it, Monsieur Brown." And he began to recite to me. "Quelle est cette île triste et noire? C'est Citerre, nous dit-on, un pays fameux dans les chansons, Eldorado banal de tous les vieux garçons. Regardez, après tout, c'est une pauvre terre." A door opened overhead, and one of les vieux garçons stepped out onto the balcony of the John Barrymore suite. Mr. Smith picked his bathing pants off the rail and looked down into the garden. "Mr. Brown," he called. "Yes." "I've been talking to Mrs. Smith. She thinks perhaps I was a bit hasty in my judgment. She thinks we ought to give the minister the benefit of the doubt."
"Yes."
"So we shall stay on a while and try again." 5. I had asked Dr. Maggio to dine that Saturday in order to meet the Smiths. I wanted the Smiths to know that all Haitians were not either politicians or torturers. Besides, I had not seen the doctor since the night when we disposed of the body, and I did not wish him to feel I had kept away from cowardice. He arrived just after the electricity had been cut, and Joseph was on the point of lighting the oil lamps. He turned the wick of one too high, and the flame shooting up the chimney made the shadow of Dr. Maggio unroll down the veranda like a black carpet. He and the Smiths greeted each other with old-fashioned courtesy, and it seemed for a moment that we were back in the 19th century, when oil lamps shone softer than electric globes, and our passions, or so one believed, were gentler too. "I am an admirer," Dr. Maggio said, "of Mr. Truman for some of his internal policies, but you will forgive me if I cannot pretend to be his supporter over the Korean War. I am honored in any case to meet his opponent." "Not a very important opponent," Mr. Smith said. "The Korean War was not an issue in the 1948 campaign, though it goes without saying I am against all wars, whatever excuses politicians may find for them. It was for the sake of vegetarianism I ran against him." "I had not realized," Dr. Maggio said, "that vegetarianism was an issue in the election." "I'm afraid it wasn't, except in one state." "We pulled 10,000 votes," Mrs. Smith said. "My husband's name was printed on the ballot." She opened her bag and, after a little search among the Kleenex, pulled out a ballot paper. Like most Europeans, I knew little of the American electoral system. I had a vague idea that there were two or three candidates at the most, and that all voters everywhere voted for their presidential choice. I hadn't realized that on the ballots of most states, the name of the presidential candidate was not even shown, only the names of the presidential electors for whom the votes were actually cast. In the state of Wisconsin, however, the name of Mr. Smith was clearly printed under a big black square containing an emblem which I think must have represented a cabbage. I was surprised at the number of parties. Even the socialists were split in two, and there were liberal and conservative candidates for minor offices. I could see from Dr. Maggio's expression that he was as lost as myself. If an English election is less complex than an American, A Haitian is simpler than either. In Haiti, if one put any value on one's skin, one stayed at home, even during the relatively peaceful days of Dr. Duvalier's predecessor. We handed the ballot paper from one to the other under the eyes of Mrs. Smith, who watched it as closely as a $100 note. "Vegetarianism is an interesting idea," Dr. Margeau said. "I am not sure it is suited to all mammals. I doubt, for example, whether a lion would flourish on green things." "Mrs. Smith once had a vegetarian bulldog," Mr. Smith said with pride. "Of course, it took some training." "It took authority," Mrs. Smith said, and her eyes challenged Dr. Maggio to deny it. I told him of the Vegetarian Center and of our journey to Duvalierville. "I had a patient from Duvalierville once," Dr. Maggio said. "He had been working on the site, I think it was on the cockpit, and he was sacked because one of the Tonton Macoute there wanted the job for a member of his family. My patient made a very foolish mistake. He appealed to the Tonton on the grounds of his poverty, and the Tonton shot him once through the stomach and once through the thigh. I saved his life, but he is a paralyzed beggar by the post office now. I wouldn't settle in Duvalierville if I were you. It is not the right ambience for vegetarianism." "Is there no law in this country?" Mrs. Smith demanded. "The Tonton Macoute are the only law. The words, you know, mean bogeymen." "Is there no religion?" Mr. Smith asked in his turn. "Oh, yes, we are a very religious people. The state religion is the Catholic Church. The Archbishop's in exile, the Papal Nuncio is in Rome, and the President is excommunicated. The popular religion is voodoo, which has been taxed almost out of existence. The President was a strong voodooist once, but since he has been excommunicated, he can take no part. You have to be a Catholic communicant to take part in voodoo."
"But it's heathenism," Mrs. Smith said.
"Who am I to say? I believe no more in the Christian God than I do in the gods of Dahomey. The voodooists believe in both."
"Then what do you believe in, Doctor?"
"I believe in certain economic laws."
"Religion is the opium of the people," I quoted flippantly at him.
"I don't know where Marx wrote that," Dr. Maggio said with disapproval, "if he ever did, but since you were born a Catholic, as I was, you should be pleased to read in Das Kapital what Marx has to say of the Reformation. He approved of the monasteries in that state of society. Religion can be an excellent means of therapy for many states of mind, melancholy, despair, cowardice. Opium, remember, is used in medicine. I'm not against opium. Certainly I'm not against voodoo. How lonely my people would be with Papa Doc as the only power in the land."
"But it's paganism," Mrs. Smith persisted.
"The right therapy for Haitians. The American Marines tried to destroy voodoo. The Jesuits tried. But the celebrations go on yet when a man can be found rich enough to pay the priest and the tax. I wouldn't advise you to go."
"She's not easily frightened," Mr. Smith replied. "You should have seen her in Nashville."
"I don't question her courage, but there are features that for a vegetarian..."
Mrs. Smith asked sternly,
"Are you a communist, Dr. Maggio?"
It was a question I had wanted to ask many times, and I wondered how he would answer.
"I believe, madame, in the future of communism."
"I asked if you were a communist."
"My dear," Mr. Smith said, "we have no right."
He tried to distract her.
"Let me give you a little more yeast roll. To be a communist here, madame, is illegal.
but since American aid stopped, we have been allowed to study communism. Communist propaganda is forbidden, but the works of Marx and Lenin are not. A fine distinction. So I may say I believe in the future of communism. That is a philosophical outlook. I had drunk too much, I said, as young Filippo believes in the future of the brain gun. Dr. Maggio said, you cannot stop martyrs. You can only try to reduce their number. If I had known a Christian in the days of Nero, I would have tried to save him from the lions. I would have said, go on living with your belief, don't die with it.
Surely very timid advice, doctor, Mrs. Smith said.
I cannot agree, Mrs. Smith. In the Western Hemisphere, in Haiti and elsewhere, we live under the shadow of your great and prosperous country. Much courage and patience is needed to keep one's head. I admire the Cubans, but I wish I could believe in their heads and in their final victory.
Chapter 2-1 I had not told them at dinner that a rich man had been found, and a voodoo ceremony was to take place that night somewhere on the mountains above Kinskoff. It was Joseph's secret, and he had only confided in me because he needed a lift in my car. If I had refused, I'm sure he would have tried to drag his damaged limb the whole way. The hour was past midnight. We drove some 12 kilometers, and when we left the car on the road behind Kenskoff, we could hear the drums beating very gently, like a laboring pulse. It was as though the hot night lay there out of breath. Ahead was a thatched hut open to the winds, a flicker of candles, a splash of white. This was the first and the last ceremony I was to see. During the 2 years of prosperity, I had watched, as a matter of duty, the voodoo dances performed for tourists. To me, who had been born a Catholic, they seemed as distasteful as the ceremony of the Eucharist would have seemed performed as a ballet on Broadway. I only went now because I owed it to Joseph, and it is not the voodoo ceremony I remember with most vividness, but the face of Filippo on the opposite side of the tonneau, paler and younger than the negro faces around him. With his eyes closed, he listened to the drums, which were beaten softly, clandestinely, insistently, by a choir of girls in white. Between us stood the pole of the temple, stuck up like an aerial to catch the passage of the gods. A whip hung there, in memory of yesterday's slavery, and a new legal requirement, a cabinet photograph of Papa Doc, a reminder of today's. I remembered how young Filippo had said to me in reply to my accusation, "The gods of Dahomey may be what we need." Governments had failed him. I had failed him. Jones had failed him. He had no brain gun. He was here, listening to the drums, waiting for strength, for courage, for a decision. On the earth floor, around a small brazier, a design had been drawn in ashes, the summons to a god. Was it a summons to Legba, the gay seducer of women, to sweet Ezuli, the virgin of purity and love, to Ogun Ferai, the patron of warriors, or to Baron Samadi in his black clothes and his black tonton glasses, hungry for the dead? The priest knew, and perhaps the man who paid for the ceremony, and I suppose the initiates who could read the hieroglyphics of ash. The ceremony went on for hours before the climax. It was the face of Filippo that kept me awake through the chanting and the drum beats. Among the prayers were little oases of familiarity. Libera nos a malo, Agnus Dei. Holy banners swayed past, inscribed to the saints. Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis hodie. Once I looked at the dial of my watch and saw in pale phosphorescence the hands approaching 3. The priest came in from his inner room, swinging a censer, but the censer which he swung in our faces was a trussed cock. The small, stupid eyes peered into my eyes, and the banner of St. Lucy swayed after it.
When he had completed the circle of the tunnel, the Oongan put the head of the cock in his mouth and crunched it cleanly off. The wings continued to flap while the head lay on the dirt floor like part of a broken toy. Then he bent down and squeezed the neck like a tube of toothpaste and added the rusty color of blood to the ash-gray patterns on the floor. When I looked to see how the delicate Filippo was accepting the religion of his people, I saw he was no longer there. I would have gone too, but I was tied to Joseph, and Joseph was tied to the ceremony in the hut. The drummers became more reckless as the night advanced. They no longer tried to muffle the beats. Something was happening in the inner room, where the banners were stacked around an altar, and where a cross stood below a pokerwork prayer, and presently a procession emerged. They were carrying what I thought at first was a corpse wrapped in a white sheet for burial. The head was covered, and a black arm dangled free. The priest knelt beside the fire and blew the embers up into flames. They laid the corpse beside him, and he took the free arm and held it in the flames. As the body flinched, I realized it was alive. Perhaps the neophyte screamed. I couldn't hear because of the drums and the chanting women, but I could smell the burning of the skin. The body was carried out, and another took its place, and then another. The heat of the flames beat on my face as the night wind blew through the hut. The last body was surely a child's. It was less than 3 feet long, and on this occasion the Oongan held the hand a few inches above the flame. He was not a cruel man. When I looked again across the tunnel, Filippo was back in his place, and I remembered that one arm which had been held in the flames appeared as light as a mulatto's. I told myself it could not possibly have been Filippo's. Filippo's poems had been published in an elegant limited edition, bound in vellum. He had been educated, like myself, by the Jesuits. He had attended the Sorbonne. I remembered how he had quoted the lines of Baudelaire to me at the swimming pool. If Filippo was one of the initiates, what a triumph that would represent for Papa Doc as he dragged his country down. The flames lit the photograph nailed on the pillar, the heavy spectacles, the eyes staring at the ground as though at a body ready for dissection. Once he had been a country doctor, struggling successfully against typhoid. He had been a founder of the Ethnological Society. With my Jesuit training, I could quote Latin as well as the Oongan, who was now praying for the gods of Dahomey to arrive. Corruptio optimi. It wasn't sweet Ezuli who came to us that night, although for a moment her spirit seemed to enter the hut and touch a woman who sat near Filippo, for she rose and put her hands over her face, and swayed gently this way, gently that. The priest went to her and tore away her hands. She had an expression of great sweetness in the candlelight, but the Oongan would have none of her. Ezuli was not wanted. We had not assembled tonight to meet the goddess of love. He put his hands on her shoulders and thrust her back on her bench. He had scarcely time to turn before Joseph was in the ring. Joseph moved in a circle. The pupils of his eyes turned up so high that I saw only the whites, his hand held out as though he were begging. He lurched upon his wounded hip and seemed on the point of falling. The people around me leant forward with grave attention, as though they were watching for some sign to prove that the god was really there. The drums were silent. The singing stopped. Only the Oongan spoke in some language older than Creole, perhaps older than Latin, and Joseph paused and listened, staring up the wooden pillar, past the whip and Papa Doc's face, into the thatch, where a rat moved, crackling the straw. Then the Oongan went to Joseph. He carried a red scarf, and he flung it across Joseph's shoulders. Ogun Ferai had been recognized. Someone came forward with a machete and clamped it in Joseph's wooden hand, as though he were a statue waiting completion. The statue began to move. It slowly raised an arm, then swung the machete in a wide arc, so that everyone ducked for fear it would fly across the tunnel. Joseph began to run, the machete flashing and cutting. Those in the front row scrambled back,
so that for a moment there was panic. Joseph was no longer Joseph. His face ran with sweat, his eyes looked blind or drunk as he stabbed and swung. And where was his injury now? He ran without a stumble. Once he paused and seized a bottle which had been abandoned on the dirt floor when the people fled. He drank a long draught and then ran on. I saw Filippo isolated on his bench. All those around him had fallen back. He leant forward, watching Joseph, and Joseph ran across the floor towards him, swinging the machete. He took Filippo's hair in his hand, and I thought he was going to strike him down with the machete. Then he forced Filippo's head back and poured the spirit down his throat. Filippo's mouth belched liquid like a drainpipe. The bottle fell between them. Joseph revolved twice on the floor and fell. The drums beat, the girls chanted, Ogun Farai had come and gone. Filippo was one of the three men who helped carry Joseph into the room behind the tonneau, but as for me, I'd had enough. I went out into the hot night and drew a long breath of air which smelt of wood fire and rain. I told myself that I hadn't left the Jesuits to be the victim of an African god. The holy banners moved in the tonneau, the interminable repetitions went on. I returned to my car, where I sat waiting for Joseph to come back. If he could move so agilely in the hut, he could find his way without my help. After a while the rain came. I closed the windows and sat in stifling heat while the rain fell like an extinguisher over the tonneau. The noise of the rain silenced the drums, and I felt as lonely as a man in a strange hotel after a friend's funeral. I kept a flask of whiskey in the car against emergencies, and I took a pull from it, and presently I saw the mourners going by, grey shapes in the black rain. Nobody stopped at the car. They divided and flowed past on either side. Once I thought I heard an engine start. Filippo must have brought his car, but the rain hid it. I should never have gone to this funeral. I should never have come to this country. I was a stranger. My mother had taken a black lover. She had been involved. But somewhere years ago, I had forgotten how to be involved in anything. Somehow, somewhere, I had lost completely the capacity to be concerned. Once I looked out and thought I saw Filippo beckoning to me through the glass. It was an illusion. Presently, when Joseph had not appeared, I started the car and drove home alone. It was nearly 4 o'clock in the morning and too late to sleep, so that I was wide awake at 6 when the Tonton Macoute drove up to the veranda steps and shouted to me to come down. 2. Captain Concasseur was the leader of the party, and he held me at gunpoint on the veranda while his men searched the kitchen and the servants' quarters. I could hear the bang of cupboards and doors and the screech of smashed glass. "What are you looking for?" I asked. He lay on a wicker chaise longue with the gun in his lap pointing at me and at the hard upright chair on which I sat. The sun had not yet risen, but he wore his dark glasses all the same. I wondered whether he could see clearly enough to shoot, but I preferred to take no risks. He made no reply to my question. Why should he? The sky reddened over his shoulder, and the palm trees turned black and distinct. I was sitting on a straight dining-room chair, and the mosquitoes bit my ankles. "Or is it someone you're looking for? We have no refugees here. Your men are making enough noise to wake the dead, and I have guests," I added with reasonable pride. Captain Concasseur changed the position of his gun as he changed the position of his legs. Perhaps he suffered from rheumatism. The gun had been pointing at my stomach. Now it pointed at my chest. He yawned, his head went back, and I thought he had fallen asleep, but I couldn't see his eyes through his dark glasses. I made a slight movement to rise, and he spoke immediately. "Asseyez-vous!" "I'm stiff. I want to stretch." The gun was now pointing at my head. I said, "What are you and Jones up to?" It was a rhetorical question, and I was surprised when he answered,
"What do you know about Colonel Jones?"
"Very little," I said. I noticed that Jones had risen in rank. Then came an extra loud crash from the kitchen, and I wondered whether they were dismantling the range. Captain Concasseur said,
"Philippeau was here."
I kept silent, not knowing whether he meant the dead uncle or the live nephew. He said,
"Before coming here, he went to see Colonel Jones. What did he want with Colonel Jones?"
"I know nothing. Haven't you asked Jones? He's a friend of yours."
"We use white men when we have to. We don't trust them. Where is Joseph?"
"I don't know."
"Why isn't he here?"
"I don't know."
"You drove out with him last night?"
"Yes."
"You returned alone?"
"Yes."
"You had a rendezvous?"